Blog Talk Radio, and this is Rebooting the News. We're talking May 10th, 2010, which happens to be 5 days after, I just found this out, 5 days after Jay's birthday.
Indeed.
Would you like me to sing Happy Birthday, Jay?
Well, I think your birthday was a couple days before that.
I know,
right?
But the way it works is whoever had the most recent birthday.
Is that how it works?
I just made that up, actually.
Uh-huh. I love hearing how it really works in the real world. Well, welcome to our listeners. This is Rebooting the News number 51.
After the fantastic 50th anniversary.
All Request Radio.
Yeah, we ought to do more of that.
Which really worked well.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Yeah. That's called, you know what they call that? They call that engagement.
Yeah, user engagement. Mm-hmm. Big theme.
Yeah. More of that.
Future of news is user engagement, absolutely.
So some people say.
Yeah. Yeah, some doubt it.
Mm-hmm. But there are, our users are very, very intelligent and thoughtful people.
Yes.
So in that case, that is the future of news. The Rebooting the News people, that's the future. But I'm not so sure about some other, you know, users.
Well, some people think that the user should just sit there and shut up and listen.
Yes. Yes, there are people.
I don't think that, but
well, no, I don't. You know, actually, so this is my rant for the week, which I'm sure you'll hear me bring up many times in the show.
Uh-huh.
It's like, what kind of communication actually ever happens, you know? Sort of the big picture question.
What kind of communication?
Is there any, I mean, everybody on the net is ridiculing our President Barack Obama, who yesterday said that, you know, iPads and iPods and all that stuff, which he doesn't use, he admits, they are all responsible for something bad, something negative. Lack of engagement, I think, maybe a good way of summarizing. Mm-hmm. I found I agreed with him. I really do agree with him that... You know, there's a lot of talking, a lot of people talking, but there ain't a whole lot of listening going on. There certainly is even less understanding, you know. You know, we say don't read intonation into what people say online because there is no intonation. People do it anyway. They do it wildly. You know, there are all these conversations that take place on the web or around the web where people say, well, you were being angry or grumpy or grouchy or nasty or, you know, a piece of whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People are doing that to each other all the time, yet we say don't do the intonation thing, right? Because you don't have it. So then the question, then another question comes up is like, okay, face-to-face communication.
Yes.
How much are we really getting what the other person's saying from that? Because we do have intonation. Are we actually correctly reading that intonation? And
so the title of this rant is, does anyone ever really listen?
Is there any communication? In other words, with 50 billion blogs, you know, I mean, I once wrote a piece called A Billion Websites. So I thought, uh-huh. Oh, what an outrageous idea. You know, well, 10 years, 15 years later, we're in the ballpark, right? So what exactly was the point? You know, and with shortening you know, 140 characters and, you know, information overload and all the rest. It's just getting worse. It's just getting worse. People are paying less and less attention.
Well, let's go back to the age of big media with just a few speakers and
everyone else sitting mute
in the audience.
No, but let's try to figure out what it's going to take to actually reboot ourselves, okay? Now that we've rebooted the technology to some extent, we need to do an upgrade for our species. We need to do a better job of listening.
This point about listening reminds me of something I wanted to talk about during this show, which is I saw this item in Advertising Age today, which I put onto my Twitter feed, that Time Magazine and others in the advertising business are going to experiment with a model in which they guarantee results.
Hmm.
What they mean by this is that they guarantee that users will remember an ad and they'll be able to measure that they've done that. And they're going to use this, of course, to charge higher rates for more effective advertising because they believe that they can do that. So that's kind of interesting in itself, but it got me thinking about something that I believe we touched on last show. Why don't news sites start measuring their success by how much people actually listen and learn about the news? I really think there's something to this idea. So let's suppose we are able to measure how much the users of a site actually gained in knowledge about the news of the week or the month.
Yeah, well, we talked about that.
Yeah.
I mean,
One way of, therefore...
You see, I was listening.
profiting would be to say to potential advertisers, we have an audience that's actually listening, and here we can show you.
Right.
As they attend to our news, they actually gain knowledge of the subjects that we are addressing.
Their brains are engaged.
It's
not just their memory that's engaged. Although memory, you know,
memory is part of it too.
Marketers care about that.
Sure,
they
absolutely.
Do.
And instead
even if it's visceral memory, even if it's memory that you're not conscious memory, you know. It's a familiarity that comes when you're looking at a shelf full of products and you say, well, I kind of trust that one. I've heard of that. You know, it's like you don't remember where you heard of it, but that memory matters.
Any kind of memory.
But then there's
matters.
The cerebellum memory.
Right. Those are different things.
Intellect.
There's awareness. There's memory. But instead of charging people to use the news site, that's a whole controversy in itself, maybe if the charge was you have to take our news quizzes and exams so we know how much knowledge you're acquiring, and then the news is free. I'm just thinking out loud here. Then that would allow us to say with a great deal of certainty what kind of information acquisition is actually taking place at the site. Then we could sell that and use that for the in-depth journalism and engaging news coverage we need to, in fact, instruct people. So if journalists began to measure their work against whether people were listening, it might lead to new models and new possibilities. Just an idea.
Yeah. I'm not too enthusiastic about these things.
All right.
I think that that news has to find a product that's like the iPad. That, you know, that makes people so want it that they will do self-destructive, stupid things to get it. You know, that has to be something that people want at such... I mean, it was an article, I think it was in the Times, yesterday's Times, where they said, they pointed out, look, these early adopters are doing us a huge favor.
Yeah, right? I saw that, yeah.
By wasting their money on beta products, which
right.
The iPad, you know, I'm going to get a lot of grief for saying this, but the iPad is a beta for sure.
That's why I'm not buying one.
Well,
right
I
now.
Think, you see, we talked about this in the locker room before the show, and so, you know what, I think you should do it. You should do it because you're not buying a product, you're buying an education. Mm-hmm. You're buying a rare place on the learning curve. You get to be somebody who understands this stuff before other people do.
Yeah.
You know, and so would you pay for, I mean, you know, our theory here at NYU is the education's worth the money, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, so that's their claim too. That's Apple's claim.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're not really selling you a product, they're selling you an education.
Right.
Yeah. I think they cannibalized the iPod. By the way, in doing this.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, the predictions that you would look at an iPhone and see it as a small iPad have proven true for me. I really do now look at my iPhone differently. It's more useful to me, actually, because of its relationship to the iPad. But it does seem very much a lesser product, less, you know, sort of ominous, less foreboding.
You know, one thing that changed my mind or opened my mind a little bit more to the iPad, which has been a gradual process since we started talking about it and since you showed it to me on the show a couple of weeks ago, is I read a very interesting argument today about long-form journalism on the iPad and how a market may develop for short books that are actually long explanatory articles that could really begin to give background and understanding to
news. I don't think so.
You don't think
so?
Why not?
No, I'll tell you why. I've actually been looking for a way to talk about this. I have been reading with the iPad. And you know,
not good for long-form reading?
No, it's not a very good reading device. Well,
I know it's hard to hold.
Yeah, that's one very... I mean, that's not a small thing. You know? I read in bed. And so whatever book I'm reading, it has to work that way.
Right.
And, you know, I'm one of these people that curls up with a book, right? And it's very hard to curl up with this thing. You can do
it. Yeah, that doesn't really work, does
okay,
it?
Okay, yeah. And then it's not, you know, I've heard people laugh. They say, oh, they laugh at the Kindle now when they look at it. But the Kindle has actually got some things that this thing doesn't. Like, its text is much more readable close up. I mean, the iPad is a nice demo of what something like that might be in as a thought experiment. The way you're using it, it's good. It's working, right? It's getting you to think about new ways of this might work. But in terms of actually reading with it, I'm not doing it. I must still much prefer to read a physical book. Much better.
You know, that might reminds me of Marshall McLuhan was just the first media theorist I ever studied. Subtitled his famous book, Understanding Media, The Extensions of Man. And his point was that media and all tools are extensions of the human body.
Yep.
And any technology that's supposed to work for us as a medium of communication has to scale with and relate to the human body. And the way it does or does not do that is absolutely critical to its success. One of the reasons the newspaper was so great was that it was properly scaled to the human body, and it was sort of easy to use in that sense. And ease of use, as we've said many times,
see,
is
I buy
critical.
It as a newspaper thing, though. I'll tell you, honest to goodness, I haven't hit the limit on that yet, because the only paper that I read is the Times, okay? And I can't buy the Times on the iPad yet. And that's a source of frustration. So I, you know, sometimes go out to breakfast at a restaurant that's on the same block. You're familiar with the restaurant. You know,
I
don't want to say what it is because I don't want whatever. But and there's a newspaper newsstand right across the street. So when I do that, I go buy a New York Times and I go sit down. And I think this is really silly. You know, for $2, I'm buying a New York Times. I'm reading about maybe 1/100th of the content in this paper.
Right.
And I still don't mind paying the $2. It's not a big deal. You know, breakfast is a bargain.
Right.
You know, and add another $2 is still a bargain. But I don't like consuming all those resources.
Yeah.
All the oil that took
right.
the trees and all that stuff. And I used to buy for 75 cents, buy the New York Times on my Kindle. And I really miss it, not being able to do that here. I think it's ridiculous. After a month of using this thing, it's been a little bit over a month, that really has not settled in as something that I accept, the fact that there is no New York Times for this thing. There is that New York Times editor's choice, which is a really poor excuse for the New York Times. It's missing so much.
Is yeah, anyone listening?
I don't know. I'll tell you what, Jake Tapper listens, though. I think... I know switching gears very quickly, but one of the things, I mean, I actually listened to this week.
I did too. I
watched
it. Yeah.
I have not listened to it in many, many, many weeks.
He did a great interview with Holder. It was excellent, his interview with the Attorney General.
Yeah, you thought so?
I did, yeah.
I think Holder is, okay. You know, this is what you do for a living, so I'll trust your judgment.
I didn't say Holder was excellent, but I thought Tapper
right,
was excellent.
I understand. Yeah. I saw, maybe what you're saying is that it, because I saw him as transparent. I didn't even hear Tapper. You know.
Well, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, of course not. No. That's a good thing. But, yeah. But I like the fact that that I can influence him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've never had an anchor of a news program that I've been able to influence. And that you've been able to influence, my God. So, should we get him on the show?
That might be a really interesting idea. Yeah.
Anybody out there listening from ABC News, I know that there are people from NBC and a few other...
All I have to do is email him.
Okay, well, he's your buddy, okay.
No, right? But I'm in contact with
there
him.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we could do that. It would be interesting because he's an active user of Twitter, and he has tried to change the format of his show, and
he listens. This goes back to what I was saying before. There's listening happening there.
Yeah, and he's a White House correspondent.
Yeah. So it wouldn't be completely, totally embarrassing to have him here, whereas I think of some other anchors that I wouldn't say the same thing about.
Dave, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Is New York City the next tech mecca?
Next question.
Explain.
It's funny because I actually, I worked up to, I got asked that question by Chris Wiggins from Columbia. He pointed me to, Chris is an amazing guy, actually, because he's, along with Evan Korth of NYU, has
great
made
guy.
It their
yep.
mission to bootstrap a tech community here in New York.
The New York Tech
and
Meetup.
So, right. And so, of course, these are my soul brothers, right?
Yeah.
I'm totally.
Some of my students attend, too.
Absolutely. And some of your students have produced some incredible results there, too.
Mm-hmm.
We saw one of them this week. Maybe you could talk about that. so Chris, you know, so I when I meet with Chris, we talk about all this stuff, and I always warn him. I say, don't overhype this, okay? Just
yeah.
stick with the results that you're generating. It's fine to talk about those, but don't extend it beyond that. Don't, you know, you have your ambitions, your aspirations. It's all very, very good, but don't make that sound like reality, because that's how you get your hype balloons and your bubbles and it overheats, and people get disappointed, and it just collapses in on itself. And
mm-hmm.
It's not a good thing. It's much better to build these things out of what's really, really happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so he started, you know, shooting me articles that I needed to rebut, you know. And so that's what I did. That's what that is. New York. Will New York be the next tech mecca? And the answer is, you know, no, probably it won't be. No, it won't. Because there's a lot of other geographies that are in the running for being the next tech mecca.
Mm-hmm.
And Silicon Valley got there first, and first is a hard thing to displace. And so we shouldn't be thinking in those terms.
So what's the niche here?
Well, I think it's obvious. You know, you can answer that as well as I can, right? It's we're the media. New York is media, right?
You know, yeah, I think... what you said in your post, and I agree yeah. with, is that what you have here is not the makings of the next tech powerhouse, mm-hmm. but what you have is this incredible concentration of talent,
right.
of people who want to write, make video, make film, make media, make the next generation of media, multi-talented, some of them established, some of them very young, some of them really hungry. And all of them looking to make a mark. And it's the intersection of some tech and that talent pool
yep.
that I think is really exciting.
Yeah, when you look back on it to see what actually was achieved here, I believe you'll find that intersection was the place where the action happened. Because if you want to make great software, you need to really have great, you need to have active users that are paying attention, that are giving you the grounding that you need, so that your products aren't just like, you know, they aren't just showing what a wonderful programmer you are. They're showing how brilliant your users are, and they're empowering them and giving mm-hmm. them the levers. You know,
right.
You have to transfer. I mean, computers are these wonderful tools that, you know, that amplify, right? But they can't just be amplifying the programmer. They amplify the user, and in doing so, that makes the programmer greater. I've always believed that the contact with the users, that's the raw material that you make these products out of. So that's what we've got here. You've got other places that have other industries present, and computer technology is so pervasive that you'll find those intersections in a lot of places.
True.
And they'll mean different things. And we just have to be set, you know, some realistic goals that are worth achieving, and then work at achieving them. You know, we don't need to be a tech mecca.
Yeah.
I left a tech mecca, and I was very happy to do that. I didn't want to be there. There was a time when I did, but this isn't that time for me. So.
You wrote in your post, what we can do here is iterate on the vision for the next level of tech, which I feel intuitively involves the humanities and media.
Oh, yeah. Well, we agree on that,
as much as it
right?
will involve memory, batteries, and input devices. What do you mean by humanities and media?
Well, it's... what do I mean by humanities and media? I mean the humanities.
Art.
Yeah, it's like
literature.
What do you talk about? I mean, if you take a
human expression,
if you have a degree that's focused on the humanities from NYU, what are you studying? Yeah.
You're studying the best that's been said, thought, painted.
Right.
Expressed.
You know, here's a way of looking at it, okay? When I was an undergrad, I was a math major, and it was hard. It was being a math major. Every time you'd go in and get a lecture from the professor, I would find that I was being stretched to the absolute limits of my intellect. I mean, it would often go beyond that, and that I would just strip my gears and totally wouldn't understand what's going on. And the same thing can happen. That same kind of challenge can happen in the humanities too. For, you know, and
sure.
And it's that combination of stretching,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you extend in both places so far that it hurts.
Yeah.
And then you come back and you do it again and you do it again. And then that learning that takes place in the intersection there, you know, that gives you a result that I think that's much more satisfying than either one. I love reading. My favorite classes as a student were the history classes and English literature. But I loved what the technology classes did for me. I mean, I loved what the math classes and science classes did for my brain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what they did for my ability to think. You know, they made it so that hard problems, you know, were something that I wasn't scared of. Yes,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's hard to explain, but I want more of that. I love it when we get students coming into. That's one of the reasons why I like being at a university, is because the assumption here is that that we're going to do hard things.
Yeah, and absolutely.
In the web, you know, this goes back to the rant that I said was going to be pervasive. In the web, we don't. You know, if I say, look, we've got some interesting stuff here, and people, you know, for whatever reason are feeling lazy, they won't look at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I would love to get the part of the web that does think that it's worth going and stretching and working hard. You know,
they show up every once in a while.
Yeah.
They're
let's
rare.
Concentrate that.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? It's like bring it together.
Yeah.
So that
that's the promise of New York. It's everything that's magical about New York. Comes back eventually to density, urban density.
Really? No
yeah.
kidding. Absolutely.
And it's the concentration of one of a lot of one
and
thing.
And also diversity too. It's like
well, yeah,
and
diversity and density together.
Right. So Jeremy Zeiler, our friend from the Times, the web guy, the blogging guy there, he talks about New York moments and how they just creep up on you. One, you're just in a place and there's 18 different nationalities and each one of them is doing their thing, but they relate to each other.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a student here at NYU, Kate Ray, who is undergrad. She was in my Rise of the Web class last year, and talk about doing something hard. She went out and for a year worked on a documentary about the semantic web.
Hmm.
And she actually went out and interviewed Timothy Berners-Lee, David Weinberger, Clay Shirky, other people, and put together her own documentary attempting to both explain what the semantic web is as well as portray some of the divisions within the people researching it about what it should be and how it should work and whether it has potential or not. And it's a really impressive piece of work for an undergrad who just locked onto something that was really hard to understand,
right.
was determined to understand it herself, and then used the tools that we have. You know, low-cost video, editing tools, the web itself as a distribution device, to make this film. And that's what we need, is like people who just do that. She didn't have to do it. It's not
right.
like her professors were forcing her to do it. It just became a cause of hers. And those are the kinds of students who, you know, you really
there
just...
There aren't many of them, actually, are there?
They're a minority. They're a minority,
even
but they do
even
exist.
Even an average student works harder than the average adult.
That's true.
Yeah.
They work hard.
I know.
They have
but,
to.
But it's, yeah.
I love that when I find that.
I like adults that work hard, too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the... I mean, it doesn't have to be painful. It's that stretching. doesn't need to stop. You know, oh, I had a thought coming over here that maybe at some point we should get my mother on this show. I know you laugh. It's funny. I would have to, like, talk with her, and I don't think she would get it. It's have to say, Mom, you can't come here and kvell. It can't be about, you know what kvell means, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, but my mother is, I don't want to say how old she is, because she doesn't like it when I do that, and she does listen to this podcast. She is very courageous, and she does hard things, and she's learned how to be a blogger. And in some ways, she didn't have to learn.
Right.
Because for her, she's one of these people I call an NBB, a natural born blogger,
mm-hmm.
that they get ideas in the shower, and then they have to express them.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to, even if nobody's listening, they have to express them. And so, you know, it doesn't have to be just young people, very, very young people. It can be people of all ages that push themselves. Just, you know, and there doesn't have to be a reason why you do it. So that's, maybe
last
New
week,
York does more of that. I don't know.
Yeah. Last week we presented our ideas for the East Village Local at the New York Times.
How did that go?
Well, it was a lot of fun. It was kind of a brown bag lunch in which the students and faculty from NYU came to the Times. We sat in the big page one conference room where they decide what's going to go on the front page every day.
Mm-hmm.
And the newsroom staff was invited. Anybody who was interested in, like, the developing plans for the local could come and listen. And maybe about 15, 20 people from the newsroom did, many of them from the Metro staff. But, for example, the Standards editor was there.
What's a standards editor?
That's the person at the Times who's in charge of articulating and explaining Times standards.
So
it went
like
well.
Editorial standards,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, news standards, yeah. So we concentrated on the three or four things that kind of move the ball down the field in hyperlocal journalism. One of them was the way that we want to do beats. Instead of simply assigning beats to people and say, okay, start producing stories about the schools or about crime or about real estate, what we're going to do is we're going to have kind of a protocol for launching beats. And the first thing is you have to produce a big sort of takeout story that explains the background of your beat, that gives the whole picture of real estate in the East Village or education or noise, which is going to be one of our beats. And then the kernel of that explanation is going to migrate over to what the Times now calls topic pages. And topic pages are sort of like Wikipedia articles where the necessary background for understanding the beat is permanently located, but also where highlights from the ongoing coverage appear, and the story is revised as new information comes in, and there are other resources for really getting a hold of this issue at the same page. And it's a complement to the river of news. It's so, because you need both things for a successful beat. You need the river of news, and then you need a place where the issue is permanently kind of given a home.
Right.
So we explained that approach to doing beats. And we explained how we're going to use topic pages not just as Wikipedia article plus archive, which is sort of what they are now, but also the place where people who really care about that beat can interact with the staff, and where they can suggest topics for further articles, where they can comment and interact with one another. So we're going to make the topic page kind of two-way. So we explained that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing that we explained was the open source assignment desk, which is something we're developing here at Studio 20 with a team from the Studio 20 program and a team from the computer science department at NYU. It's a WordPress plugin that permits the local to do several things at once. First, it's a workflow system for articles as they move from the idea stage to the draft stage to the finish stage. Secondly, it allows any contributor, student or someone from the community, to log in and see a list of things that need to be covered or done and pick up an assignment or nominate herself for an assignment, which then has to be approved by an editor. And then it also allows anyone from the community or any other contributor at NYU or from the East Village to suggest something to be covered, to suggest a story that should be done.
So what are the three things again? So you said there
it's a workflow system,
right,
for keeping workflow. Track of where everything is I and see. What stage it's at.
So people can suggest ideas, they can find out ideas that have been suggested, and they can, and if they're an editor, they can approve ideas.
Right, and they can get assignments.
Okay.
So in other words, suppose I want to write for the local. So instead of going through 35 emails to the editor and getting the assignment in a back and forth way,
right,
I just log in and I look at what needs to be covered today, this week.
Right.
And it contains instructions also on how to do that and what kind of product and results at the end. And you can nominate yourself to cover things that need to be covered. And
I've seen it, by the way.
And you've
maybe
seen
some
it.
Screenshots would be helpful. On the show notes, if we can get those, so that people can visualize this, because I think it's very important to actually see.
It is, yeah.
You know, to actually see it, because it can sound complicated.
Yeah, it can sound complicated.
But it actually is not.
It's not that complicated. It's fairly simple. But what we presented was that if the East Village Local is to meet its goal of being 50% community contributed, which is part of what we're trying to do here, then you need a workflow system that actually opens out to the community. And being able to log in and see what assignments are available to you, as well as being able to log in and suggest something to cover, are two ways of opening up the
process.
It's
amazing that there is nothing like this out there.
I know.
Yeah. And but it was also strange to find out that that they don't have something like this at the Times for their internal use, for their own professional.
Not yet.
You know, and it's funny because the content management system vendors have been promoting this functionality for decades. They've been saying that they have it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I was surprised to find out that they don't.
They don't, and it's going to be fairly simple, because all you'll need is to be a registered user of the New York Times,
right,
to do it. So what will enable any New York Times blog, they have over 100 blogs.
This is going to be for all Times blogs.
Well, it's going to be a WordPress plugin. It's not only going to be for all Times blogs, it's going to be for anybody who uses the WordPress system to publish their site.
It's also open source. So
yeah, it's open source.
On any system whatsoever.
Yes. But what I'm saying is that as we develop it and use it at the East Village site and work out the bugs and, you know, change it so that it actually operates smoothly, that any of the Times blogs, over 100 blogs they have, that wants to increase the community portion of the site, you know, contributed by the users, would be able to use this system to do it.
Well, what's nice about it is that it's community involvement that isn't a comment system.
Right. So it's nothing to do with comments.
Right.
Exactly.
And so it's up till now, basically, the assumption has been that you want to bring community into your site, you do it with comments. And that has led to a lot of misunderstandings about what community involvement entails.
Comments is far too limited.
Right. This might actually have a big impact in that it brings people in a different mode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And even if it's only 1% of the users who would actually do it, that's still a lot of people.
Right. That's, you know, when, of course, that's a lot of people. And it's funny how people used to criticize blogging and say, well, you know, most users won't do this. Yeah.
Right.
And that's fine.
Exactly.
You know? I mean, that's still a lot of people. That's a lot more people than there were reporters before, you know.
Exactly. So. It's what's the reference point? The entire population of users or the very small number of producers we had before?
Right. There's a difference in order of magnitude probably in the end.
Completely.
Yeah. That's interesting. So when will this be available to people outside of the NYU and the
I'm hoping that it will be available in the fall.
Okay.
We're going to do a lot of work on it over the summer and turn it into a WordPress plugin that anyone can use. And we're also going to be doing a lot of the debugging ourselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's possible we'll find that we built this wonderful functionality, but nobody actually uses it for what we thought. That's definitely possible. Mm-hmm. Because it's not simply building the tool. You also have to organize the community and motivate people to use it. But I think we will get people using it, especially if they find that they can log in, suggest something to be covered, and it actually gets covered, right? Once they see it working and it goes through cycles like that and it's proven effective, I think they will use it. But it's up to us to show the utility of it. Anyway, it's a good example of what Studio 20 is about, because if this thing can be proven to work and it becomes useful not only to the East Village Local, not only to the Times, but to anybody who's a user of WordPress, that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great.
We'll keep you updated on it.
So what's next?
Newsweek.
Newsweek, right.
Big news this week for followers of Newsweek. The venerable news magazine was put up for sale by its owner, the Washington Post Company, who said when they put it up for sale, I love this way of attracting buyers, we see no path to profitability for this magazine. Anyone want to buy it?
Well, you have to figure that it's funny, isn't it? But, yeah. You know, there's got to be a backstory to this, right? I mean, you normally don't put things up for sale that have huge, enormous value by saying publicly, we're putting it up for sale. Right. That would be, no matter what, on its
sort
face,
of a last step, right?
It's an act of desperation. Yeah. It's not even a last step. Right. It's like nobody showed up to buy it, you know, or the prices were so utterly ridiculous.
Or our bankers told us to forget it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I wonder if there's no... I mean, the thought that popped in my mind was, you know, wouldn't the Newsweek.com domain itself be worth some money? I mean, you know, what if... I mean, venture capitalists... finance companies, Stack Overflow, a New York company, just raised $6 million mm-hmm. from venture capitalists. That meant that their value must have been at least, you know, $15 million, mm-hmm. something in that ballpark. So what was Newsweek worth? I mean, wouldn't it be worth at least that? I mean,
well, it's hard for me to answer that, Dave, because what's so strange about this situation is that Newsweek claim to reinvent itself this last year or so. And I attended very closely to what it and its editors said when they did this, because whenever you have a title like that that reinvents itself, they're drawing on certain ideas, right? So what are the ideas? And in this case, it was, instead of just summarizing the news like we used to do as a news weekly, we're now going to bring you more analysis. And at the same time, we're going to bring you these voices, you know, strong voices, like Fareed Zakaria, who's one of their columnists. You know, basically columnists and analysis. Mm-hmm. But what they didn't do is explain to us either what kind of base of knowledge lies behind the analysis that they are going to bring us. Is it economic analysis? Is it analysis that comes from a deep knowledge of society? Analysis doesn't sort of come from the cloud. You know, it's not something that
your view
you
from
just,
nowhere.
Yeah.
You can't be a view from nowhere and have thoughts like this.
And exactly. Right? And when it came to their opinion, which is saying essentially we're going to start selling a view of the world, they didn't bother to tell us what world or what view it was.
Probably because they were confused about that they didn't realize.
Absolutely.
That.
They had none. They didn't have a view of the world.
And well, Zakaria certainly does.
He does. Yeah. Well, fine. Then if you're going to make Newsweek the Zakaria magazine, that's cool. Like,
that
develop
could have
that.
Competed with The Economist, for crying out loud.
Well,
I mean,
that's the other thing they said, is more like The Economist. But The Economist also has a view of the world.
Absolutely.
And so what they did essentially was they bet on a strategy that requires a view of the world and then declined to develop one. Mm-hmm. Because they also wanted to be completely in the mainstream of American journalism in their thinking, right? They didn't want to go outside. They didn't want to color outside the lines.
See, this goes back to, like, let's solve some hard problems. Let's do some hard work.
Mm-hmm.
They abdicated from doing
the
hard work.
They refused to do that.
They just said, you know, we're
they
we're,
took a pass on everything that was hard. They took a pass on.
What is it when they pre-med students, what classes do they? They take classes that they'll be likely to get A's in. I forget what they call those.
Guts.
Is that what they call them? I always used to hate pre-med students, and you know, they
because they have to take organic chemistry.
Well, they had to take math classes until you know you
organic
were,
chemistry is the one that I always remember that really
well
challenged
that
them.
Weeded them out.
Yeah, the weeding I mean, them out. Yeah,
that was the place where the you know if you didn't get through that one, you didn't get to be
right. So Newsweek wanted to take basket weaving
and softball
and yeah,
study softball
and phys ed.
Yeah.
And now they could have said, John Meacham, their editor, is famous for saying this sort of thing the pundits always say, you know, America's really a center-right country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he believes that. Fine, then make a center-right magazine and sell it to the country.
Right.
And tell us why you're doing that. Another thing they could have done would go international, right? We're gonna be the American news magazine that brings you the world in a way that the others don't dare to do because they're just not international enough. That would be at least an idea. A third thing they could have done was to say, you know, people kind of know the news, and they know more the news than ever, but what they need is to be able to explain it, to feel some sort of mastery over it. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be your weekly explainer with a vengeance, and we're going to do a better job at that at our site and in our print magazine than anybody
you know,
out there.
I understand,
that would be an idea.
I understand that that is what makes books sell, nonfiction books. That exact idea that you just talked about is that if it gives you, if it arms you with a few stories that you can tell at a dinner party.
And a sense of mastery
that, right, then,
over
then
a subject that
you're
you
gonna buy the book.
Know a little bit about.
Because yeah. You'll hear about it. Word of mouth will carry
totally.
It.
Totally. That
know?
Would be the niche.
Yeah.
It would be that weekly.
Yeah, there could have been. That's why I say that there had to have been some value for the brand name of Newsweek. That's what I'm saying is that couldn't somebody with some creativity come along and find a way.
Essentially, the current editors dissipated the value by refusing to make a choice about what direction to
well,
go.
Well, you know, this makes
you
know.
That's why
company.
I ridicule them
there's
on Twitter all the time.
I gather, but nobody's ridiculing Yahoo, but Yahoo is sort of doing the same
similar,
thing.
Similar, yeah.
It is very similar. Yahoo has a lot of diverse
assets.
You know, yeah, yeah, and some great stuff, like Flickr, for example. You know, Flickr's been stagnating, you know. While all this social networking stuff's coming up, you know, Flickr was there long before any of these other guys were there, and it still occupies a relatively unique niche.
Yahoo life, Finance.
Right. I mean, you could breathe life into any one of
Yahoo
these
Autos.
Things. Exactly. And even and news, of course, was big.
News.
So I don't know how organizations get past this. I don't think they generally do. I mean, you know, once you get to sort of a place where, you know, survival inside the organization becomes more of overcoming the internal politics of the organization, you know, and that happens very quickly. There are very few organizations that escape that. I mean, Microsoft is a black hole gravity well like that now. Didn't used to be that way, but it is that way now.
Yeah.
Apple seems to have escaped that. Because they have that charismatic leader who
right.
who has a vision and takes these big bets and has a pretty good track record. And they, you know, the way I see it,
90
a company
seconds.
Like Apple gets somewhere because people have a, you know, if they're sitting in a meeting and they say, well, what would Steve do here? And they have a good answer for that question. Who do you identify with Newsweek? If it was
right.
Farhid Zakaria, well, yeah, then you would have had
then
something.
Let's have Zakaria's magazine. That's right. the problem with John Meacham is that he struts around like a visionary leader.
Mm.
He's on TV all the time. He publishes best-selling books that are works of history.
Yeah.
You see him on the pundit shows.
60 seconds.
And he's a very visible representative of the magazine. So he struts around with this charisma, but he's not willing to actually chart a vision for the magazine.
You can hire strutters. I mean, they make a lot of money, right?
Well.
Most companies are run by them. I mean, that's a fact. They
Newsweek's run. For sale. We see no path to profitability. Anyone want to buy it? That's
sure.
That's where he ended up.
I would love to buy it.
All right.
So I brought my checkbook with me. Dave.Weiner@gmail.com. Send me an email. Maybe we could do a deal, you know.
Tim, I hope you're listening.
It's been one of my dreams is like to take over the Philadelphia Inquirer before it completely shuts down and just own their website.
You want a news brand, huh?
Yeah,
Newsweek. I could see that.
Newsweek would be, I mean, what the hell? Anyway, we're out of time.
Dave, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, look forward to number 52 next week.
Bye, everyone.